You're listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find other episodes of The View and to subscribe to this podcast, visit questformeaning.org/VUU.
Well, hello there. You have joined us for another episode of The View. Well, I'm glad you're here. It's Rabbi Arthur Waskow, who is the director of the Shalom Center in Philadelphia. And Arthur, I'm just so delighted that you're here to talk to us about all kinds of stuff, your activism and where you see kind of radical Judaism right now, or I guess we'd call it Jewish renewal. I'm just excited to see you.
I'm excited to see you, Meg. It's been a while.
It's been a while, yeah. And Arthur, this is Tom Shade, who's in Cleveland right now. And he has a story he's dying to tell you about how he knows you.
All right.
Actually, the first Seder I ever went to, you led at George Washington University Student Union in 1970.
Oh, my God. I remember that. That was 1970.
Was it 70? Yeah.
At the end, we marched to the White House afterward.
I think I skipped that part, but anyway, I remember that, and I'm not Jewish, and it was the first Seder I ever went to. Many of my friends were Jewish. I'm saying, I thought that was great. I thought that was so super. They said, yeah, but that's not like what it is at my house, you know? Right? So, they didn't want me to think that was what everybody did every year, you know. And that was, I think, one of the first times you used that particular...
The second year. The first year was 1969 in the basement of a black church in Washington, downtown Washington.
So, Arthur, you have a compelling story about your first-year encounter with Unitarian Universalism at All Souls a few years earlier than that, right?
That's right. Well, I got a phone call from folks at All Souls saying that they did not have a minister on hire for the following year, and they had decided to invite different people, one each week, each Sunday morning, through the year, so I guess 52 of us, to lead services. Would I do it? So I'd never led a service, but I knew Unitarianism through the anti-war work we were doing, etc. And I loved All Souls, and my kids actually went to a elementary school that was housed at All Souls. I don't think it was sponsored there, but it was housed there. And I said, sure. And they told me that I could change anything I wanted in the service except for one thing, and that was I couldn't change the collection, the money collection, right? So I had enough of a memory of what Jewish life was like to think there was, if there's something in the service you can't change, that's the real service, everything. So I planned the service. In those days, recordings were on a reel-to-reel recording thing, and you could put a tape on and it would spin through and play, and I put the Doors' Light My Fire on it, and I put a song by the very radical singing group called The Fugs, which said, it was a Monday, nothing, Tuesday, nothing. It was based on an old Yiddish song where it said, Montag bulbus, Dienstag bulbus. Bulbus are potatoes. So that song meant there was nothing to eat except potatoes all week long. All you could eat was potatoes. So I put that on with a nothing, and then I went off on Sunday morning to All Souls Church in Washington, actually more or less in my neighborhood, and I began, and I used like my fire. Some people were upset and left, other people were excited and clearly involved, And I got to the point where it should be the collection, and I invited them to do the collection. That was unchangeable. Then after the collection was for when I intended to give the sermon. So I said that it was the church that was going to have to write the sermon, not me. I was going to ask a question, and they were going to have to write the sermon as an answer. And my question was this. I had thought to myself, again, thinking sort of Jewishly about Unitarianism, what is Unitarian tradition anyway? And what is the Torah of Unitarian tradition? So I figured it was Henry David Thoreau and Emerson, and especially Thoreau in jail because he refused to pay taxes to support the war against Mexico, which is mostly called in the U.S. the Mexican War, but it wasn't the Mexican War, it was the U.S. War against Mexico, just like the Vietnam War.
My child points out all the time, that's pretty much true of all of our wars, yes.
Unfortunately, right. So I reminded people the story of Thoreau in jail for refusing to pay taxes to support the war, and I reminded them, they probably all knew, that there was about to be a trial in Boston of five people, including Benjamin Spock, who was America's grandpa, Mark Raskin, my good friend at the Institute for Policy Studies, Michael Ferber, who was a young Unitarian student, Bill Coffin, great preacher, etc. The charge was conspiring to aid resistance to the draft. So I said, in the light of Unitarian tradition, my sermon was a question. Would they devote the collection to the legal defense fund for these five people in Boston? And I sat down. And there was a big hubbub. And finally, a guy I'd never met came forward. He introduced himself as the president of the congregation. And he said, well, normally we would not have a community meeting on Sunday morning, but WASCO has faced us with the necessity of doing that. So the meeting is now in order, and the question on the table is, shall we devote the collection to the Legal Defense Fund instead of the purpose for which it was originally collected, which was supporting the building fund? So people argued, and they argued, and they argued. And some people said, yes, this is truly a Unitarian action. We should certainly devote the money. And other people said, no, the building fund needs the money. And finally, one person said, well, it just isn't fair because people gave the money thinking it was going to go to the building fund. So we can't really take it. And then somebody stood up and said, that's true. But we could take up another collection. And they all voted to do that. So then there was a collection, and three times the amount of money that had been collected for the building fund were collected for the Legal Defense Fund for the Boston Five. So that's the story.
Were you ever invited back? I'm just curious.
They got a minister, so I don't think any of us were invited back. I did get a letter a year later from some of the members saying that they still recall that it was incredibly moving, and they just wanted me to know the whole question and the tone of it was still alive at All Souls a year later.
That's great. Now, you started out as a secular Jew activist, right? And then at some point said, I need some religion to help me through this. Can you describe that process and what, I mean, I'm just really interested in where you are now. I mean, how you've been at this for so long.
Right. And, it's true. So it is pretty long. But it wasn't like I thought I need religion to get through this. This is what happened. March the 31st, 1968, Sunday afternoon, I have been nominated by my neighborhood caucus to be a member of a District of Columbia, D.C., a Washington, D.C.-wide slate for delegates to the Democratic National Convention. we were the outsiders. Our platform was end the war, end racism, and free DC. And we came together and from neighborhood caucuses came up with a slate. It was chaired by a young black minister in very much the Martin Luther King mode, Reverend Channing Phillips, may he rest not quite in peace but in power. And there we were, and I had just begun doing that. And we were preparing a campaign. We were the outsiders, and Lyndon Johnson was going to have a delegation for him, and it was going to be really hard to beat him. That Sunday afternoon, Johnson goes on national television, and he announces he is not going to run for re-election. He's going to send Avril Harriman to Paris to talk to the NLF, the National Liberation Front of Vietnam, which up till that moment the United States government didn't allege didn't exist. And now we were going to negotiate with them directly. And he was hoping to end the war. The immediate response to that in the folks I was watching the TV with, and it turned out in several dozen places around the district at least, was to go to Lafayette Park across from the White House and begin to dance and sing. And the police arrested one person and then 20 minutes later brought him back and de-arrested him because they couldn't figure out what to charge him with. And it was as if the government had fallen, right? The war, it seemed, had. In fact, the history turned out different, but it seemed that way that moment. That's on March 31st. And there is then Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and most of Thursday, the shortest era of good feelings in American history. And on Thursday, late afternoon, Dr. King was murdered. The next day, April the 5th, we've just passed the death anniversary for Dr. King on April 4th. On April 5th, black neighborhoods all over the United States erupted, including the black neighborhood of Washington. And I had been invited to go out to American University on the edge of the district to speak at a memorial service for Dr. King. They were happening all over, and I did. And I said at that service, well, I'm really glad to speak at the memorial service for the man who, so far as I'm concerned, was president of the real United States of America, the people. But he wouldn't have said, just sit here and do a service. Go do nonviolence. So there were rumors the president was going to send the army into the city of Washington. We decided, a whole bunch of us, almost 100 people, decided to walk from American University downtown to the White House and to demonstrate against the war and against sending the police or the army into the city. So we walked all the way from American University to DuPont Circle, which is in sort of edge of downtown, and we paused to drink some water and rest a little, and somebody walked over and said, what are you guys doing? And I explained, and he said, don't you know what's going on? And I said, what do you mean? He pointed at the sky, and there's this pall of smoke over 14th Street, which had begun to burn. So we caucused to say, well, do we give up now or we go to the White House? Everybody said, we go to the White House. So we went to the White House, and we picketed on the Lafayette Park side of Pennsylvania Avenue, and finally decided, this is silly, we're gonna cross the street and picket at the fence. And we did, and at that point, the police, without any warning, charged the crowd, beat on, not really terribly beat up, but beat on some of us, including me, and arrested us on some charge or other. I have no idea what. Maybe just
they put a curfew in place. Weren't you violating didn't they make everyone go home?
Well, the rules weren't nearly then the way they are now. So I'm not sure. Maybe just disorderly conduct. Anyway, we went off. And you could then either post $15 as a fee to show up and then forfeit it if you didn't show up, or you could, I don't know, make some arrangements to actually stand trial. And I thought to myself, I asked when the trial would be, if there was a trial. They said, about 3 weeks. I said to myself, 3 weeks from now, we're going to appear before a judge who was going to say the city was burning and you were distracting the police by having your demonstration at the White House to the slammer with you. So I forfeited the $15. And we had already, we, meaning a network of people in the civil rights and anti-war movement in Washington, had already been planning what we called the Center for Emergency Support. You could taste the rage in the black neighborhoods, and we knew there was going to be an uprising that summer. I actually had written a book about race riots, and it always in July or August they exploded, and who knew they were going to explode on April the 5th. But we put together this network. Besides sending, Johnson sent the army into the city, and they occupied the city. They took over schools, they took over the traffic circles, so you could set the army and machine guns in the traffic circle and command six different avenues of access from where the avenues came in. So they occupied, and Johnson proclaimed the curfew. In theory, it applied to everybody. But in fact, the police didn't care if whites were on the streets. There were more than 5,000 blacks arrested, only charged violating the curfew. So we organized to get food, medical supplies, doctors, lawyers into the black community, which otherwise was totally cut off by the curfew. And for a whole week, that's what I was doing, day and night. And then came the first night of Passover, 1 week after Dr. King was killed. The only Jewish practice I had kept as a grown-up was the Passover Seder. Not Rosh Hashanah, not Yom Kippur, I don't think even Hanukkah, only the Seder. It was about freedom. My family had always taken freedom seriously and justice seriously and the Seder seriously. So I went home to get ready for the Seder. But that meant walking past the army with a Jeep with a machine gun pointed at the block I lived on. And my insides, my kishkas, my innards began to say, more than my brain, began to say, this is Pharaoh's army. I'm going home to do the Seder, and this is Pharaoh's army on the streets of Washington. So the Seder turned into a volcano of energy. It had always been serious, but never a volcano. And it was like discovering an extinct volcano, which turned out not to be extinct, in your own backyard. You had no idea it was there. And I was blown away because I was blown away. I went, what's going on, Wasco? Why are you so driven by this? There's a line in the traditional Haggadah that says, the service for the Passover Seder, that says, in every generation, every human being, doesn't say every Jew, every human being must look upon himself, herself, as if we go forth from slavery to freedom, not our great-great-great-great-grandparents only. And I had read that line every year since I could read, but it never occurred to me that it meant anything real. But that year, wow, it exploded. So I walked away from that Seder really startled, moved. We were elected to the Chicago Convention, the famous, infamous Chicago Convention of the Democratic Party in 1968. I served as a delegate from D.C. we were committed to Robert Kennedy. When he was murdered, we decided to nominate as a favorite son, old American tradition, of course, never a favorite daughter till very recently. We decided to nominate the chair of our delegation, Channing Phillips, for president. And he became the first black person ever nominated for president at a major party convention. And then the convention went bluey, right? I mean, Mayor Daley's cops attacked people on the streets, and Mayor Daley's sergeants at arms in the convention attacked people, delegates in the convention. And okay, I went away with every identity I thought I had, independent radical scholar, liberal Democrat, blown away, except one. And that, to my surprise, was being a Jew. That fall, driven, not chosen, driven, I sat with the Haggadah I was given when I was 13 years old and became Bar Mitzvah in one hand, and passages from Dr. King, from Gandhi, from the slave rebellions of the 1830s and 40s, and the Warsaw Rebellion, of the Warsaw Ghetto Rebellion of 1942 in my left hand. And I took the stuff in my left hand and I wove it into the Haggadah. So the Haggadah was not only about the ancient, ancient liberation struggle of ancient Israel from slavery under Pharaoh, if that remained, but all this other struggle for liberation was there as well. And I shaped it, in fact, into an argument between, I mean, these people from different continents, different centuries, even, into an argument between violence and nonviolence as an avenue toward liberation, toward freedom. So I was doing that, driven. I had written three books by that time, but this book was writing me. It wasn't me writing it. I found myself, I would write a paragraph and call up one of my friends and read the paragraph. And half my friends said, Bosco, that's amazing. That's wonderful. And the other half said, Bosco, you can't do that. There is a Haggadah for Passover. Nobody can write a Haggadah.
Talk about disrupting order, right?
So I decided I better get advice from some serious Jew who was for civil rights and against the Vietnam War, because there's no point in asking anybody else. To get a frank opinion, I got the name of a young rabbi in Washington, Harold White. I called him up. I explained what I was doing. I said, would you give me your frank opinion? Is this just crazy or is it a good idea? He said, well, it sounds interesting. Anyway, send it to me. So I did. A week later, he calls up. He says, Bosco, I love it. It's an activist midrash on the Haggadah. Mm-hmm. Activist, I wonder if you know the ancient rabbinic activist midrash that said God wouldn't split the sea until one of the Israelites walked in up to his nose, ready to drown. Not till then, when an activist was ready to act, would God split the sea. And I said, what's a midrash? And instead of saying, so who needs to talk to an ignoramus like you? He said, oh, let me share the midrash with you. So what is midrash? What I learned was that the ancient rabbis 2,000 years ago taught that the Torah was not written in black ink on white parchment. It was written in black fire on white fire. And of course you have to learn to read the black fire, the letters, but you also had to learn to read the white fire, the blank spaces. And midrash is the reading of the stories in between the lines, in between even the letters. And I was blown away all over again at the idea that you could take a 3,000-year-old text, give it a twirl, and it would come out somewhere new. And I was especially blown away at the idea you could still do that. It wasn't just 2,000 years ago. The rabbis did it once and for all, and forget it. We could do it. I could do it.
And you have been doing it.
That's right.
I'm thinking that a little more than 20 years ago, and you have been doing it for decades. You were one of the founders of what is called the Jewish Renewal Movement, right? That was bringing that to fire. Can you describe that? That is really, most of the Jews that I know, that's the fire they warm themselves around at this point.
Well, people ask me, Jewish Renewal, that's a nice label, but what is it? What is the guts of it? And I often say, well, can you get your head around feminist Hasidism? And most of them say, feminist Hasidism? No, I can't get my head around that. But the Hasidic element, especially brought by Rabbi Zalman Schachter Shalomi of seriously blessed memory and still active in the world, even though his body ain't in the world, he grew up in Lubavitch Hasidism and its teachings and experience, more than teaching, about direct experience of God. And that's what Hasidism, at its best, is really about. He, as he said, graduated from Lubavitch. They didn't throw him out and he didn't quit. He graduated. He graduated learning first time from Paul Thurman, the black theologian, Christian theologian, who was one of Martin Luther King's crucial teachers.
Howard Thurman?
Yeah. Oh, I said Paul. Right. Sorry. Howard Thurman. That's right. And when he told the people back at Lubavitch he had met a black Christian tzaddik, they said, no, can't be. And he said, I trusted my eyes, my ears, my nose more than what they were telling me back in Brooklyn. So he then began to learn from Thomas Merton, from Sufis, from Buddhists, he was able to integrate it all into his very broad and deep sense of Kabbalistic Judaism. And then he went out into the world to begin teaching this new, and he said, 2,000 years ago, the Roman Empire shattered Biblical Judaism, and it took about 200 years of struggle for rabbis to develop what we now look on as rabbinic Judaism.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Some Jews said, hey, this Hellenism stuff, it works great, and they joined up, forget about Torah. Some said, there's only one way to do it, and everybody else has given up, we're going off to the Dead Sea, and live in caves there, and we'll do it right. Some people even built altars way far away, the upper Nile, Elephantine, and did the sacrifices according to the Torah, with it, but not in the temple, because the temple was gone. And some people said, the world's upside down and inside out, must be time for Mashiach, for the Messiah. And by the way, have you met this extraordinary, charismatic young rabbi from the Galilee named Yeshua or Jesus? And some said, there's a lot that's disgusting about Hellenism, but some value, maybe we can learn from the value and create a new Judaism based on words rather than on the body and food, but based, which was the offering at the temple, and not connected to the land anymore because we aren't connected to the land anymore. So what Zalman said was, we are now going through what they went through. Modernity has done to rabbinic Judaism what the Roman Empire did to biblical Judaism, and we need to create a new paradigm of Judaism, and we are doing it, and that's what Jewish Renewal is.
I need to say I never met Rabbi Zalman, but I know a lot about him through his good friend and my recently deceased good friend, Ibrahim Farajashe, who is a Sufi and did a lot of Jewish Muslim work with him in really profoundly experiential and radical ways. So I love him, though I never had the pleasure. I've watched him on video, but I never got to meet him. But amazing energy that man had. Just loving kindness, amazing. Wow.
So Jewish Renewal, I am now much more interested in what I'm calling transformative Judaism, a Judaism that sees the mission of the Jewish people as the healing and transformation of the world, not just a little act here and there of being nice, or even a little act here and there of reform, but the transformation of the world, healing the world from what the human species has done by pouring far too much CO2 into the atmosphere, burning. I don't talk about global warming. I talk about global scorching. Warming is a pleasant thing for most people. Scorching is much more accurate. Healing the world from that, drawing on Torah to do that, the tradition of the sabbatical year, reminding us that you can't make the earth work without any pausing. Chapter 25 of Leviticus describes the sabbatical year, and then chapter 26 says, and what happens if you don't let the earth rest? And the answer is, oh, the earth gets to rest anyway on your head through plague, through famine, through drought, through flood, through exile, which we would translate as mass refugees, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sounds to me, when I read chapter 26 of Leviticus, exactly like James Hansen and the other climate scientists warning us what's happening and will happen worse if we don't stop pouring CO2 into the planet. So that's an example. New ways of thinking about God. One of the ancient names of God, one of the ancient biblical names of God, in Hebrew, Yud Hey Wav Hey, in the Western alphabet, YHWH. Many of us get taught in comparative religion courses, oh, that's Yahweh. The Jewish God had a name just like the Babylonian God or the Egyptian God, and the name was Yahweh. Ain't true. There were never any vowels. It wasn't Yahweh, and it wasn't Yehovah. So we were taught for the last 2,000 years, the rabbis have taught, and my grandmother, teaching me Hebrew, taught, when you see YHWH, you say Adonai, which means Lord. When my grandmother taught me that, I said, but you just taught me the letter for the D sound and the N sound, and they're not there. Can't be. She said, I know. Just do it. So for many, 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 many years, decades, really, I just did it. And then one day, in the midst of working with a class at Swarthmore University, having a conversation with Martin Buber, who was dead, of course, but we were having a conversation with his book, I found myself saying, well, Professor Buber, you were a rebel, I'm a rebel. What would happen if I disobey my grandmother and all those rabbis and tried actually pronouncing YHWH with no vowels? So I did, and what happened for me was, a breath. And I thought, oh, that makes sense. At least one of the real names of the real God shouldn't be in Hebrew or Egyptian or Sanskrit or Latin or Greek or English or Russian or Zulu, but in all of them. And the only sound that really is in every human language is just breathing. And the second thing I thought was, it's not just human languages. Every life form on this planet breathes. And not just in a little bubble all by itself, but we breathe in what the trees breathe out. And the trees and grasses breathe in what we breathe out. The interbreathing of oxygen and CO2 is what keeps all life on this planet alive. So that seemed to me like a really powerful metaphor for God. For me, and it turns out for a lot of other people I've talked with, much more powerful and much more truthful metaphor than king, lord, up there, judge, us poor schleppers dragging along. So that's an element. Not everybody in Jewish renewal has pursued that path, but a number of us have, and the whole notion that we need to rethink who, what God is. As Reb Zalman used to say, when people would say to him, I don't believe in God, he would say, you know what? The God you don't believe in, I don't believe in either. That's the God we learned when we were 10 or 11 years old. I don't believe in that God, the king sitting on the throne God. No, let's have another vision of who, what God is, and the interweaving of all life, the interbreathing of all life, really a better metaphor. So both in liturgy and prayer and in social action. So it turned out, for example, that notion of reconfiguring Passover as a social action change event in the present, not only a memory of the past, that began to transform what Passover was for hundreds of thousands of mostly American Jews, where people began writing their own Haggadahs. I mean, the whole notion that you can't write a Haggadah, people began writing feminist Haggadahs, vegetarian Haggadahs, earth-oriented, climate-oriented Haggadahs, Haggadahs in honor of the mothers of the Plaza de Mayo in Argentina against the junta, the fascist junta in Argentina, Haggadahs like that. And then it spread beyond Passover to other festivals. There's a midwinter Jewish festival of honoring the rebirth of trees. And we did it one year in the Redwood Forests of California, where there was a corporation that was cutting down 2,000-year-old redwood trees. And we, first of all, did the sacred meal that goes with Tu B'Shvat, the name of that festival. A meal where you eat only fruits and nuts, a meal where nothing has to be killed, not even a radish yanked up by the root, because fruits and nuts are totally available, many more than the trees need to replenish themselves. We ate that meal together, celebrated, and then completely walked onto the turf of this corporation to plant new redwoods where they had torn them down. They were all ready to arrest us. The cops were there. And at the last minute, they evidently were ordered to vanish because I think the owner thought it would be worse PR to arrest hundreds of Jews and other folks for planting redwoods than it was to let it happen. So we developed this whole connection, which was really new, between the festivals. They were no longer just ritual. The festivals became activists. Of course, if you go back far enough, when Rabbi Jesus from the Galilee led a demonstration of Jews against the Roman Empire, he chose the days right before Passover, which became, in Christian tradition, Palm Sunday. But when you go back and read the book of Luke, it describes how they gathered deliberately before Passover. And of course, if you're going to challenge an empire, Passover is the right time to do it. So they gathered up on the Mount of Olives, and they began marching into the city, and they were chanting psalms, of course in Hebrew. They were all Jews. And the Gospel of Luke says some of the conservatives watching began yelling at Jesus, tell your followers to shut up. And he answered, if they were quiet, the very stones would speak. So I was invited, I think 5 years ago, by Reverend Donna Schaper at Judson Memorial Church in New York City. I was invited to give a sermon about Luke on Palm Sunday. So I took that line, the very stones would speak. And I said, in our generation, the very stones are speaking. The icebergs, frozen stones, are wailing as they melt. The coral reefs are shrieking as they die. The mountaintops of West Virginia being destroyed to mine more coal more cheaply are moaning as they are destroyed. The very stones are speaking, and it's our task to speak as well. I think maybe the only time, except maybe for the Unitarian Church, when it all sold, when I've given a midrashic sermon in a Christian church. And I felt wonderful about being able to do that. So that's Jewish renewal, right? Being able to draw on the ancient text and go forward in a really new way, even newer than the rabbis. Wait, I'm not hearing.
Yeah, at the heart of it is liturgical renewal. And that liturgical renewal generates, once you open up the, once you say, okay, it's okay for me to write a new Haggadah, then that starts to transform the religious life. Now, you know, among Unitarians, you know, are kind of, our, you know, like all souls, you can change everything except the collection. You know, but, you know, we don't have that liturgical tradition, and so it's hard to have that kind of earth-shaking renewal by changing something that's unchangeable. Though you did it at All Souls, and these days, you know, a lot of Unitarian churches give away their collection every week or give away half their collection. So even that has become, you know, kind of changed since 1968. Everything changed since 1968. You know, so I just, you know, did you go get after this, I was going to use the word epiphany, and I'm sure that translates. After this revelation in 1968 and in struggling with the Haggadah, did you go get rabbinic training somewhere? What was that like to go into a more conventional rabbinic school, and then,
yes, I did, but no, I didn't get it in the more traditional. What happened for me was this. The Freedom Seder really caught on. That thing that I wrote that fall, we actually did in the basement of Channing Phillips's church, the guy we nominated for president. He was at a church. 800 people came. It was on the first anniversary of Dr. King's death, which was the third night of Passover in 1969. And we did it several years in a row. One of them you were at in 1970. But 69, there were 800 people, half of them Jews, and the other half black and half white Christians. It was an amazing event. And Ramparts Magazine, which was sort of the Mother Jones of its day, published the Seder, the Freedom Seder, and thousands of Jews all across North America said, yes, that's the kind of Judaism I did, right? And it spread. So I then found myself working with a group of Jews in Washington, first a group that was politically active called Jews for Urban Justice. We created a new kind of congregation without a hired rabbi, something closer to a house church or house fellowship, Chavurah, which means fellowship. We created that. I learned my way deeper and deeper into it. I wrote a book called God Wrestling. Then I wrote a book called Seasons of Our Joy, which was about the Jewish festival cycle. And I was pleased with being able to do all that stuff without being a rabbi. And in 1990, because of a conversation with Reb Zalman, because I was more and more understanding the way in which the original rabbis had been revolutionaries and radicals in their era, creating a whole new kind of Judaism, I decided I did, after all, want to become a rabbi. So by this time I'd learned a lot, but there was still enormous to learn. And in fact, I'll tell you a story about what it felt to become a rabbi, about learning. So I asked Reb Zalman and Rabbi Max Tipton, an extraordinary conservative, capital C, conservative, lower L, liberal, progressive rabbi in Washington, Rabbi Laura Geller, a reform rabbi in California, and a non-rabbi, Dr. Judith Plasko, the leading Jewish feminist theologian to make up a rabbinical court to govern my study. It's the old-fashioned way, before seminaries existed, especially before Jewish seminaries existed. That was the old-fashioned way you became a rabbi. It was by apprenticing, the way it used to be for lawyers, for example. So the four of them, Judith was kind of intrigued. She said, Arthur, how can a non-rabbi ordain a rabbi? And I said, look, Judith, first of all, I got three rabbis. So if you're worried about the halakha, about the Jewish law, about ordination, covered. Secondly, I don't want to join the rabbinate the way it is. I want to join a midrash. By this time in my life, I knew what a midrash was. Unlike 1968, I want to join a midrash on the rabbinate, and you are the midrash that I want to join. She said, well, still seems a little odd, but okay, I'll do it. So the four of them for 5 years told me what they wanted me to study, what they wanted me to do. I wrote a book called Down to Earth Judaism, which was in a sense like a PhD dissertation for the rabbinate. And at the end of 5 years, they said, well, we think you're ready. And I said, I think I'm ready. So I was ordained after 5 years. Not this, the ordination happened in 1995. Already, you know, 35 or so years after. I think of it as an epiphany, so I'm going to use the word an epiphany in 1968. So it was interesting. It was a, you might call, neo-traditional, but not conventional way of being ordained. And, and the process was extraordinary, because not only that process, I was learning, I was soaking up everything I could soak up. Oh, when the day I was ordained, Reb Zalman said, so what do you want to share with us about your thinking at this moment? And I said, well, truly, the only thing that comes to mind is this. Up till this moment, I thought I was a reasonably knowledgeable American Jew. Now, I feel like a totally unknowledgeable rabbi. And my friend, Rabbi Mordechai Liebling, said, Arthur, that's how you know you really are in the club. All of us know there is no way to know 3,000 years worth of tradition. So you get it, and that shows you really get it.
Well, Arthur, I would love to continue with you, but we are out of our scheduled time for this, and it looks like Meg has some technical difficulties, because if you notice, she hasn't moved in a couple of minutes on her little picture there. So I think, oh, there she is.
Oh, how weird. Well, Arthur, it's been lovely. I always learn. I always learn. Yeah. And, you know, your life is such a blessing. So I'm really glad that this worked out.
Well, for me, it's really a joy and a blessing. That first encounter so many years ago with a Unitarian congregation can be kind of fulfilled at a different level of spiral here almost 50 years later. Just amazing to me.
Isn't that amazing?
Thank you so much.
Thank you. I always think of you pastorally when I was in the Washington office years ago, and I used to send out via AOL an email every week. It was before blogs or websites, anything. And I was talking, frankly, about being burnt out, and you wrote to me three words, honor the Sabbath. And I wrote back a little whine, but I work on Sundays. And you said, well, have it a different day. And that was so useful. And my whole staff now honors a digital Sabbath, and I have held to that. That's just one of the many blessings that you cast out in the blink of an eye. So thank you so much for coming today and for your life.
We say when somebody does something wonderful and extraordinary, Yasher Koach, straight and strong. Thank you, and straight and strong to both of you and to everybody who gets to watch this. Thanks, and shalom, salam, shanti, peace, earth. Be well.
Amen.
Bye.
See y'all next week. Bye-bye.
This has been a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To find out more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.